In the world of technology, this year might be called the year of the mobile app. App is short for applications, and applications are like software programs that you can install on your desktop PC, only these are for mobile phones. Morning Edition's technology guru, Mario Armstrong, showed me one of his favorite apps. Mario, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I understand that this is something that you think I could really use.
Yes. I mean, I think in America, I think we carry three things. I think we carry our wallets, our keys, and a cell phone. The issue has been we haven't really maximized the use of our cell phones. But to me, these cell phones today are like mini computers. So they do give us a range of tools that we could be using.
Okay. So what's this one?
So this one is called Compare Everywhere. This one is on the Google Android operating system, which is on the new T-Mobile G1 phone. And what I'm going to do, we have a book in here. Business Stripped Bare is the title of this book.
Okay.
So the idea is that you're out shopping and your phone gets turned into, using the digital camera on the phone, a barcode scanner. So Compare Everywhere allows you to scan items while you're shopping, and it gives you the price and the information of that item, but also looks for other locations to see if there is a better deal.
Okay, let's check it out.
Okay.
So you're just basically pointing the camera at the barcode on the back of a book.
And it's scanning.
Uh-huh.
And it's now found it. And so I'm going to hand the phone to you so you can actually see. You should see
okay.
A picture of the cover of the book and the title, as well as some prices.
It tells me that I could buy this book at Barnes & Noble for $21. I could buy it at FYE. What is that?
That's a retail store.
For $24. Or I could go to a library at American University and get it there.
Because it looks at the localized area. Now, if you scroll a little bit further down, you start seeing the online prices.
The best price is Overstock.com for $13.
So you saved 11 bucks.
Hey.
So maybe you shouldn't have left the house after all. You could have just ordered from online.
And will it work on all kinds of products? I mean, is everything in the world in here?
So that is a limitation of this particular application. For example, I tried scanning the Suave skin therapy lotion, and it did not find this particular item.
How do you imagine people would use this? I mean, you'd find an item and see that you could buy it for $3 or $4 cheaper somewhere else. You're supposed to run out of the store, leap into your car, drive over. I mean, do you think people would really do that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I think, one, if there is a significant enough deal, then absolutely. But more importantly, I think it just starts to get you thinking more about your shopping habits and how you could be saving money.
Does this program make money for the people who created it?
So right now it's a free application, so I'm still trying to understand the business model. I don't pay for the service, and there's no advertising along with the service. My gut tells me the relationship that they're building with the online properties that you would purchase it from, there would be some type of revenue or sharing or commission that they may receive.
You know, I can see how I might use something like this, but could you put it on any mobile phone?
So not all mobile phones have the same a variety of applications. To understand the amount of applications that are out there, we're talking about 140,000 plus applications. If you add up Apple, if you add Palm, if you add Windows Mobile, and service providers like Hand & Go offer all these applications, everything you can think of.
Now,
I didn't show you iSafe. iSafe is one that shows you whether or not you're in a crime-ridden neighborhood.
Oh, jeez. Mario Armstrong. He is Morning Edition's regular technology commentator. He also hosts the radio show Digital Cafe on Baltimore Public Radio's WYPR.
As we just heard, the success of Toyota, as well as the Detroit 3, depends in part on batteries. Car companies need stronger, more efficient batteries that won't also jack up a car's price, and that's the problem. Now a group of 14 companies is asking for $1 billion in federal money, and its name says it all, the National Alliance for Advanced Transportation Battery Cell Manufacture. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
For a little battery history, Jeff Chamberlain pulls this one out of the Wayback Machine.
You remember that? The first cell phones were, I remember my father carrying around a satchel for the battery. So things have advanced in the last 20 years immensely. Now we have cell phones that last a couple hours that have a tiny little battery in it.
But batteries still aren't small, cheap, and safe enough yet to power an all-electric car. And that's what Chamberlain is working on as a manager at the Argonne National Lab.
There is a move right now to make a different format of cell, and that format is much bigger than what's in your cell phone and much bigger than what's in your laptop. It's a bigger cell, and so it contains more energy.
To date, Asia, and particularly China, has dominated that movement. Chamberlain's division at Argon is advising the group of 14 companies to try to catch up. The alliance includes Johnson Controls, which makes auto parts, among other things, and chemical giant 3M. They hope pooling resources and sharing the cost of building a manufacturing plant will speed up the mass production of the lithium-ion batteries needed to power electric cars like the Chevy Volt. By Chamberlain's own admission, this isn't an easy job.
There are a lot of challenges, but the first and primary challenge is building a battery that is not so large that it doesn't make sense.
Today's technology is still either too clunky or doesn't pack enough punch to power a vehicle long enough distances to make practical sense. Toyota's popular Prius uses a nickel metal hydride, but that's a gas electric hybrid. The EV1, GM's electric car experiment from a decade ago, was too heavy.
Another key issue is safety.
Right. Remember how faulty cell phone and laptop batteries exploded? While those were a tiny minority of cases, battery-powered cars won't get many takers if consumers have safety concerns. Finally, one of the main challenges is cost. A battery to power a car right now runs about $8,000. That cost needs to get down to several hundred dollars for it to be an affordable car. Ralph Broad is a consultant and an advisor to the new alliance. He says getting costs down means mass production.
It costs, you know, a significant amount of money to put up a plant. And so far, nobody in the U.S. is in a position really to invest several hundred million dollars that it takes to build the plant.
Mike Tracy is an engineer and a consultant for the auto industry who is not working with the alliance. He says there's no doubt electricity-powered cars are the future, but the technology needs to make vast improvements from where it is today.
There is nothing simple about the advances that everybody is looking for in battery technology, which is why the scope of the dollar amounts are so large that everybody is after.
The batteries will have other uses in the military, transportation, and energy industries.
You're literally talking about one of the most important developments of this century if it gets pulled off. The question is, which country is going to get there and which country is going to gain the strategic advantage in the world by having that technology and leveraging it?
But with so many industries asking Washington for money, it's not clear whether, how, or when the money the alliance wants to invest in this new technology will come through. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
I'm back now with Omar Gayaga, our resident tech expert, as we continue to look at the effort to put tech to work for good. And Omar, I guess we could call this e-charity. And I'm interested, from your perspective, what are perhaps the three best examples of how technology is helping us help others?
Well, one of the biggest changes is accountability, the way people keep track of where their money went and how it's being used. Also social networking, the way people connect with other people who are giving or the organizations themselves. And also just the physical ways that people are donating. People can donate by texting the word kettle to the Salvation Army. Quick $5 donation via your mobile phone. It doesn't really get any easier than that.
But I just want to make sure I understand that I text the word kettle and the Salvation Army automatically gets $5 from me.
Right. It's charged through your mobile carrier. And, you know, they've rolled that out in a couple of cities, and it really doesn't get any easier to donate $5 than that.
You know, I understand how technology makes it easier to give or makes it easier to coordinate some sort of philanthropic effort, but computers can be a bit cold. And I'm wondering if technology could depersonalize the act of giving, whether you're giving or even getting that thank you note, if it comes in your inbox along with all the other emails, from the pitches and the schedules that you get.
Well, I found actually the opposite to be true. Earlier this year, I donated to a website called Donor's Choice. The site connects teachers and students to people who would like to donate and really breaks it down to a specific project at a specific school. A few days later, after I donated, I received an email from a Mr. Schmidt who was trying to raise money for AV equipment for a school in Wisconsin, a low-income school. So a few days later, I got a note thanking me, telling me what that money was being used for, and made me feel more connected to that charity and made me feel like I had helped some people.
If you've ever been involved in any kind of charitable work, one of the things that they will tell you is make sure that the people that you're speaking with hear your passion, hear your heart and your voice. How do you do that on a computer?
Well, a lot of the charities have embraced social networking, but have also set up places where people can share their stories or post videos and photos. I'm thinking specifically of one called sharinghope.tv that the American Cancer Society built. And there you can hear from cancer survivors who post videos like you would on YouTube. You know, the site doesn't do the hard sell. You don't see a huge donate button, you know, right in front of you every time you see a video. Instead, you're seeing people tell their own stories, and it really puts a face on the organization.
Omar, you've mentioned a lot of different examples, but is there one that stands out in particular as a sort of a example A of how technology has changed the way that we can participate in charitable giving?
Well, gift cards are always a big deal during the holidays, and there's several websites, including Charity Choice, where you can purchase a tax-deductible gift card and give it to someone as a gift. The gift recipient then goes to the website and is able to choose from a pretty wide list of charities where they want those funds to go, including the Red Cross, the NAACP, and the Sierra Club. It really puts a new spin on what's becoming a very traditional gift of gift cards.
So instead of a scarf or a pair of slippers, I'm going to give you this gift card, which is a chance for you to give something to someone else and maybe feel pretty good about yourself.
Yeah, and it's also a lot easier to wrap.
Of course. Thank you, Omar.
Thank you very much, Michelle. And I'll be posting links to all of the sites we mentioned and a few others on the website, npr.org/alltech.
That's Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman, and he speaks to us on our All Tech Considered segment. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. It's time now for our weekly technology segment, All Tech Considered. Last week, we took you shopping in a virtual online mall. This week, we get into the true holiday spirit. We're going to talk about giving, and we're not talking about merchandise. And I'm joined once again by our tech guru, Omar Gayaga. Hello, Omar.
Hi, happy holidays.
Help us understand what we're talking about when we examine this intersection where charitable giving meets new technology.
Well, we're not just talking about giving necessarily. We're also talking about charities, nonprofits, even some for-profits using technology for good. They've really come to embrace the grassroots to raise money, but also to raise awareness and to mobilize people. So they're using technology in really new and interesting ways.
Well, speaking of using technology in new and interesting ways, we wanted to look at an unfortunate situation that's fairly common. A loved one or a friend or a neighbor is sick or is grieving, and someone wants to pitch in with a home-cooked meal or perhaps running an errand or making sure that someone gets to the house to mow the lawn. And we found a company online that actually helps people coordinate all that goodwill. From this company's website, you can create your own local site, complete with a calendar where friends can sign up to help. It even includes a photo gallery and a place to post words of encouragement. We sent NPR's Noah Adams to find out exactly how it works.
Lots of Helping Hands. It's all one word, LOTSA, Helping Hands. It is .com, not .org. We'll explain the .com part in a minute. The local websites are free, private, and quickly set up. In Potomac, Maryland, Marcy Sussman's friends came together online after she told them she had breast cancer and would have a double mastectomy.
It was peace of mind before I went into the hospital. It was peace of mind to me that somebody didn't need to make telephone call after telephone call to set it up.
Deborah Panich is the coordinator of the website they call Sussman's Helping Hands. The members, to find out how Marcy's feeling, for example, just log on and check Deborah's update.
Marcy came home from the hospital Friday afternoon. She's doing well, managing the pain with Percocet and Motrin. Joey and Benji are glad to have their mommy home, but are understandably having difficulty keeping their distance from her. To that end, any playdates would be very much appreciated.
We had a great lasagna meal, which was perfect for the kids, one of their favorite foods.
Updates, playdates, and of course the food.
Chicken teriyaki with potatoes and green beans. We had spaghetti and meatballs one night.
Most of the neighbors know Marcy, her husband David, and the boys from the nearby Orthodox synagogue. And with the website, Deborah explains, if somebody is slow to sign up for a mitzvah, a good deed, they might miss out.
And they call me up, and I'm like, I wanted to cook for Marcy, but, you know, all 30 days are gone already. And I said, I'm sorry.
There's, I think, 95 people on that list.
The parent company, Lots of Helping Hands, started 3 years ago. The co-founders had made money with dot-coms, and they thought, why not put tech to work here? They call it social good for profit. Most of the revenue comes from co-branding. Let's say a healthcare company or a hospice group wants to offer its own Helping Hands service with access through its own website. They'll pay a fee to do that. For nonprofits like the Lance Armstrong Cancer Foundation, there's no charge. Co-founder Hal Chappell explains.
We offer Lots of Helping Hands to more than 50 national healthcare organizations. They get to offer to their audience, extend their goodwill, have their name associated with this type of service to family caregivers.
Marcy Sussman's site in Maryland went up in November and will continue to be useful. Last week, Marcy found out she'll have chemotherapy throughout the coming months. Noah Adams, NPR News.
The economic crisis is a big focus of the new Obama administration, but other parts of the transition team are working on less headline-grabbing details, like picking a new computer system for the White House. Some tech industry titans are already weighing in on this decision. Google and Microsoft are both pushing the White House to adopt a kind of network configuration called cloud computing. Cloud computing? Well, it's not as ethereal as it sounds, says NPR's resident tech guru, Andy Carvin. Think of it this way. Before, if you wanted to type up, say, your resume, you'd use the word processing program you have installed on your computer. But now?
Now there are tools out there that make it possible for you to connect to web pages that do the word processing for you. So, for example, Google. Google has its Google Docs tools. So if you wanted to create a spreadsheet or any type of text document, you would simply go to a web page that has all the functionalities of a word processor. But because it's taking place on the internet, you can access it from anywhere and you can get other people accessing it as well.
In other words, there's nothing different than I'm doing. I'm still typing my resume. But instead of my resume being saved on the computer under my desk, it's being saved somewhere out there in the cloud, someplace I don't even know of.
Yeah, it's exactly that's it. It's the cloud.
So we're already cloud computing.
Absolutely. That's the thing that's so hilarious about all this is cloud computing. The internet is cloud computing.
Now, if the White House is going to use this kind of computing, the next question has to be, is it secure?
One aspect of cloud computing is actually knowing where information is.
This is government contractor and computer security expert Kevin Jackson.
If you don't know where the information is, how can you prove that it's being protected?
Right. See, it seems to make sense to me if you have a computer and you have to protect what's in it, that you just secure that computer really, really well.
Right. Absolutely.
With a cloud, what do you do?
Right. One of the aspects of it is actually proving that information has not been changed by a bad actor.
It seems like levels of access would be another question.
Access control.
Right.
Managing who can access it, when they can access it.
And it's not just a question of who can get a hold of sensitive government information, but whether the government can get a hold of your sensitive information. Then again, Jackson says in some ways cloud computing is more secure.
If you think about it, let's say all your information is on a sheet of paper. If you take that sheet of paper and encrypt it and put it in one location, that's typically how things have been done in the past. But in the cloud, if you take that sheet of paper, encrypt it, then tear it up into four or five pieces, and then put those pieces in five different locations around the world. Now, even if someone got one of those pieces, they wouldn't have all your information.
Are you saying that cloud computing could actually be safer?
Yes, in a lot of ways it can be safer because there's no physical location for someone to attack. In fact, if you look at Amazon or Google, a piece of information actually exists in multiple locations around the world. So it'd be difficult to even identify where that information is, let alone go after it.
There are other distinct advantages to cloud computing. It makes collaboration on projects vastly easier, and that's something the government is notoriously bad at. Many people can work on one single document instead of saving 12 different versions of it on 12 different laptops. Vint Cerf is the scientist known as the father of the internet, and he's now at Google. He says there's another advantage.
If this administration evolves in the way that it appears to be evolving, it's likely to be a very substantial and increasing interest on the part of the public in engaging and seeing what the administration is doing. So the cloud is just a really good paradigm for achieving that objective.
So if all the tech gurus, Vint Cerf, Microsoft's Steve Ballmer, the people at Google, think the White House should use cloud computing, is there really any choice? There is. Up to now, internal White House computer networks have been kept behind heavy firewalls. The new approach would mean a rethinking of all the systems and regulations now in place. And if the transition team isn't even sure if Obama can have a BlackBerry, switching the entire White House to cloud computing could be more change than they want to take on. Say you're watching Brigham Young take on Arizona tonight in the Las Vegas Bowl, and a receiver stretches to catch a pass at the goal line. At the same time, a defender smacks the ball out of his hands and out of bounds. So, is it a catch? Is it a touchdown? Is it a fumble? Referees turn to the instant replay. But what if the football could tell you what happened? It's science out of the box. Priya Narasimhan teaches at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Her specialty? Embedded real-time systems. She and her students have planted a GPS inside a football, and they're working on special gloves that could determine whether a ball was caught or fumbled. Priya Narasimhan joins us now from member station WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Go Steelers!
Go Steelers!
So how did you come up with this idea?
When I first moved to Pittsburgh in 2001, I caught the football bug here, and I've never looked back since. I throw things at the TV when a call doesn't go my way, and it was really inspired by doing that and recognizing that if you did have ways to track various things on the football field, it would be a really interesting concept to try and supplement today's refereeing with additional electronics that you might put in the football, in the uniforms, in gloves, and other things.
So what exactly do you put inside the football, for example?
So inside the football, we've done a couple of things. We've put a mini GPS unit inside the football, and the GPS unit then allows us to track the football as it moves around the field of play. Hmm. So, for example, if there's a quarterback who throws the football, then we can track the trajectory of the football as it's moving in the field of play. And we're trying to improve this all the time because, obviously, we'd like to get this to a finer-grained resolution so we can actually get it down to inch level.
How's the resolution right now?
We're at about 30 feet, which, as you can imagine, is very far from doing, you know, a fourth and inches versus a first down.
Yeah.
And this is the very first prototype of it.
Now, it occurs to me that when someone throws a football, it kind of goes in a spiral motion through the air. Does that mess with the GPS?
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. And so what happens to the GPS unit is it's latching onto satellites in the sky. So as you can imagine, the ball is spinning around, and if you have a GPS unit inside, 1 minute it finds the signal, the next minute it doesn't. So it's cutting in and out of the signal. So additional things we've done is put base stations, which transmit wireless RF signals around the football field so the ball is continuously in contact with something. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not GPS, it's in contact with something else that it's relaying its coordinates or its position on the field of play.
So I understand there's also a pair of gloves. What do they do?
So the gloves are standard issue wide receiver gloves. They have a set of pressure sensors on every one of the fingers, and they're sewn into the gloves. And whenever the player makes contact with any object, the pressure sensors will fire, telling you exactly how much pressure was applied when that object came into contact. So, for example, someone who's catching the football, we can tell you how that person caught the football, whether they caught it, all of those different things.
Could it revolutionize the instant replay?
That's one of the hopes. I mean, I don't think this will ever replace human referees because human referees can make very interesting decisions based on their vast experience, based on having seen the same play at multiple different games. But this thing could supplement their decision-making, especially if, you know, for example, a coach throws the red flag on a field and you have to go to instant replay or you have to go back and, you know, re-decide the call that you just made. I think this could supplement their decision-making.
It makes me wonder if there are other things you could do with this technology, like track the hands of a surgeon or something.
We've actually done something similar for the deaf. We took another variant of these gloves. We had sensors, again, embedded on all the fingertips. So somebody who's deaf and signs using American Sign Language, we can capture all their gestures because we can tell you how much each finger was bent, what the relative distance between hands are, etc. We capture those gestures. We relay them to a phone using Bluetooth. And then the phone speaks the word out aloud, so somebody who's deaf and speaks in American Sign Language can talk to somebody who doesn't know American Sign Language.
On the phone?
Using the phone as the medium for actually voicing whatever you were gesturing.
Wow. Priya Narasimhan, she's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.